Okay, here we are back, hour number two. Welcome. This is going to be another historic radio broadcast, and it'll be in the archives and probably listened to for a long time to come. We did a program some weeks ago with remote viewer Dick Allgaier from Hawaii. He is extraordinarily talented, a gracious man who has a gift. And we are joined as well with our friend and colleague of many years, your friend as well, gentleman Jim Mars, one of the truly great journalists in American history, in my view. He has been studying the JFK murder for 52 years and said of our last program with Dick Allgaier that we probably put out more information in the 2 hours we were on the air than any radio program has ever put out. He was very pleased, so was I, so was Dick, and so were many of you. We're going to talk tonight about whodunit, the people involved with the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. This is a very tricky area. It's going to be fascinating to find out what remote viewer Dick Allgaier found out when he was tasked by Courtney Brown of the Farsight Institute, just a number. I think it was A47 or something. That's all Dick had to work on. And you can see him standing at a whiteboard drawing what he is seeing in his remote viewing status. It's a very interesting state of mind. But first, let's say hello to Dick. Welcome him back. Hello, my friend. How's everything in Hawaii?
Hawaii is great, Jeff. It's 80 degrees tonight. But with that 10-mile-an-hour wind, the wind chills down to about 77, 78.
How can you even use the word chill with a straight face?
Yeah, it's perfect. It's great here. It's great to live in Hawaii.
Yeah. Well, you've been there 38 years, something like that?
Oh, yeah. 30 years.
Something.
30 years.
Wow. All right. Let's mosey on down to Texas. And talk to the man. This man, this friend of mine and ours and yours, again, has done truly magnificent journalism regarding the JFK murder for 52 years. He interviewed as many people as he could possibly get hold of that were involved directly, indirectly, tangentially to the murder, and found out things and compiled data. His mind is like just a living library of data. It's absolutely extraordinary. Hello, James.
Howdy.
Howdy.
Just before we go anywhere else, I'm just going to set the mood here. I was absolutely blown away by Dick Allgaier's remote viewing because as soon as he put those faces up there, I knew every one of them. It all fits.
He was doing his viewing, and he drew faces, and you recognized them immediately.
Yes. And then, of course, then we started adding his descriptions to them, it even became more apparent.
Unreal.
Well, that's interesting, because I didn't. I was totally, I was just mystified. I didn't, I thought I was doing a bad session. I thought, I'm not answering the question here.
No, you answered it very, very well. However, right off the bat, I'll say this. We'll probably discuss this later. And I think, Dick, you'll probably agree with me that there are multi-levels to the forces and the people and the individuals behind the assassination. And you kind of homed in, I think, on some of the more important ones. But wouldn't you agree that there were others involved there?
Yeah, and that's what we're going to get to in the show, and I want to ask you a lot about that. Hey, before we get to that, Jim, I have a copy here of your book, Psi Spies, that came in the mail, the original actual real book. I had bought it on a Kindle, Amazon, but thank you for sending that. That was a really nice thing to do. It's a great book for all the listeners. Jim Mars, Psi Spies, the real story of how the military remote viewing unit at Fort Meade came about.
The real story.
And
yeah.
That's the one, Dick, that I had ready to go in the summer of 1995. And I think they knew well enough what was going on and that I was writing this thing, but I don't think they thought that I was going to do the really good digging journalism and go back and find the history and find the research and find the psychic research that had been done by a lot of people before the CIA and the military got involved. And then also the fact that every single one of these military remote viewers, while they were never officially tasked to go look at UFOs, every single one of them have had personal experience with UFOs to show that it's very real. And I think that's why that at the last minute, even with copies pre-sold, even with all the publicity out, the books already published, they stopped it, canceled it, chunked it. And then at that same time period is when they ask Ray Hyman and Jessica Utz to do a study for the CIA. And then just a month or two later, I think it was probably about October or November of 95, they came out with an announcement, a press release from the CIA saying, yes, here's what we were doing in this classified program on psychic remote viewing, but we don't think we got very much good out of it. And so we're going to discontinue this. And just thought you need to know, when did the CIA ever broken open one of their secret compartmentalized programs, you know? It was just an effort to keep the public from realizing the reality and the efficiency of properly done remote viewing.
Well, it's a great book, and I've read all your books, Jim, I think just about all those. So for the listeners, if you haven't read Jim Marr's books, Sci-Spies details the remote viewing, Crossfire, the new edition is the Kennedy assassination, and then go down the list, Alien Agenda, Population Control. His books are just fabulous, and it's the real history of humanity and
America. It's a university it's a university grade education. If you read all Jim's books, to hell with college, you wouldn't need to go. Just read them and study them, and then listen to this program. That would help. Remember Sherman Skolnick?
Oh, yeah.
Sherman was a frequent visitor on the program 20 years ago. Lots and lots of visits. He said something which I was very proud of and still am. He said, you parents out there, he said, don't waste $100,000, $200,000 on your kids. Don't send them to college. Have them listen to this program for 1 year, and they'll know more than they'd ever know at a college, unless they want to go into
Jeff,
a field.
There was an article came through the other day by some association of alumni and college presidents and our, you know, administrators, and it shows only 3% of 1,000 colleges now offer any education in economics. No, 3%.
That's it.
3%.
And
they're also deficient, of course, in math and history. This is why we are now, you know, half the country is going into debt trying to pay for college educations, and yet they're dumber than ever before.
Well, and the kids would be the last to tell them that what they basically do in college now is drink, have sex, drugs, and party. That's what they do. And then they cram on the weekends if they have tests. It's just, it's not what you think.
Hey, I think you went to my college.
I think they all about the same anymore.
Well, you know, it's difficult. I don't know if you guys know this, but I was up until recently working in the mainstream, mainstream America, people that aren't educated to a lot of this. So if you've read every one of Jim Marr's books and you've listened to Jeff Rentz, or I've listened to you, Jeff, 10, 15 years, you can't have an intelligent conversation with someone who hasn't been exposed to this material. You don't know where to begin to even tell them anything.
That's an important point. It causes a lot of people interpersonal relationship difficulties, shall we say. It's just difficult when there's such a bridge there to be made, and you can't make it because they don't have the data.
Exactly.
They just don't, and they're never going to get it. It's that simple. They're not going to get it in the government schools. They're not going to get it on the boob tube. It isn't going to happen.
Well, you know what? This is interesting, but about the one thing that everybody can pretty much agree on when it comes to the Kennedy assassination is that it's controversial. Okay? The problem is, it's really not. It only seems controversial because there's such a gap between those who have listened to the government, listened to the corporate control mass media, and don't know anything else, as opposed to those who've actually studied the case.
Well said. Now go ahead, Dick.
I was going to say that.
Talk a little louder if you can, please.
Oh, okay. Most people who know that there's something fishy about that and know that Oswald probably either didn't kill him or didn't act alone. If you were to ask them who did do it, I don't think people know. Even me, I'm well read. If you would have asked me a year ago, I would have said the CIA maybe and under orders of the bankers or the military-industrial complex.
Would have been a good guess. Very good guess. Sure.
Well, this is why I'm going to be interested to hear from Jim tonight, because I saw what I saw in my session, which wouldn't have been what I expected. And I know there's more to it, and it'll be interesting to hear what he thinks about it.
Now, you can get this session that you just heard Dick mention, which actually shows him working in front of a live recording, a live video, on his whiteboard and doing his remote viewing.
Now, Dick, on the video, there's that little pixel scrambling that goes up on kind of the upper right hand. Is that in there just to make sure so nobody can say that it was edited and spliced together later or something?
That was to cover something we don't want to show at this time. That's all I can say.
Oh. We like that. That's fun.
Yeah, now you really got my curiosity going.
Now, what you're going to get, if you contact the Farsight Institute, you can get a copy of the DVD of Dick Allgaier doing this and the remote viewing that we discussed the last time Dick was with us, that being in Dealey Plaza in the micro. And right down there in the plaza, not around 10, just he was there. It's fascinating. And you can get both those on DVD and watch him work, watch him draw. He's a very good artist. Draw and write what he's seeing. You'll hear him in stream of consciousness talking about what he's seeing in his mind's eye. I guess we can use that expression, Dick. Mind's eye, I don't know. How would you use it?
That's a good description. It's what you perceive.
This video, Jeff, if you go to farsight.org, there's a button there, and it's a streaming video on Vimeo. So it's a pay-per-view, and you can pay to own it. And you don't have to wait for a DVD to come. You can watch it in high definition.
Right tonight, right now. Yeah, good.
Yeah,
very good. Well, the way you walk, well, you're not conscious of walking people through. You're kind of talking to yourself. Well, I see. I have a feeling of something like this over here, and I get an impression of this over there, and it's just amazing to watch. That's all I can say. Because you're so damned accurate. And I think that might scare some people somewhere, but...
It should. I swear, I think the Cold War ended because of the psychic studies, not only in the Soviet Union, but then our remote viewing over here. And all of a sudden, the Cold War, which was built totally on secrecy, we didn't know what they had, they didn't know what we have or what our intentions were. And then all of a sudden, there was no more secrets, and the Cold War went away.
Well, the book Schroeder and Ostrander really tore the covers off the thing in the 60s, wasn't that 60s?
Right, in Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain.
Yeah.
And that's what prompted the Pentagon to start working on remote viewing on our end.
Exactly.
It's kind of funny because these old generals, they said, we don't believe in that crap, but by golly, if the commies are doing it, we got to do it too.
That's right. And the Chinese are doing it, and major corporations are hiring remote viewers. A lot of the Stargate veterans from the Army, from the military, get jobs frequently from big corporations to do remote viewing on competitors and all kinds of things. It's quite a big scene.
And now, it's been out 20 years. It was,
yes.
Okay, your book came out. You started working on your book, Jim, 25. It was published in 2000.
Right.
So and
it was due to be out in 95.
Okay, so this has been out in the civilian world for 20 years. I've been doing it really intensely for 18, 19 years.
Oh, wow.
So now we're seeing the civilians that are able to do this and taking it to hopefully a new level.
Right.
That's the point of this.
Right.
Yeah. Now, okay, let's get started. We're going to roll through the bottom of the hour break. Jim Morris, the world's foremost expert on the JFK murder, and Dick Allgaier, in my view, no finer remote viewer, there may be some as good. We'll have Daz Smith on here in another week or so, week and a half, with Courtney Brown and Jim Morris to talk about another aspect of the JFK shooting that Daz Smith remote viewed from England. What was your target code again, A47?
No, this one was 1ZSE-3GBU, I think.
All right. So the other one was A47 or something like that. That was the Dealey
yeah.
Plaza, and you were there in Dealey.
Well, let me explain how this worked, because this is important before we get into this. This is why it takes a long time to do these projects. You cannot do targets like this sequentially. They have to be segregated. So you can't do that first session and then say,
of course not.
Right?
Yeah.
So what happened was I did that first one, and then I did this one about a month and a half apart. I did the first one in middle of the summer, and this one was in the fall, I think September. I did other projects and other targets in between them so that I'm looking at it fresh. They weren't done anywhere near to each other. So I was totally fresh going in, okay, here's a new target. I don't know what it's related to. I had done another project in between, Jeff, and you've seen some of that work, and you know it's nothing to do with Kennedy. So what happens is, I'm told, here's this target, and I generate, do a target, and we generate the target ID, 1ZSE-3GBU.
That's all, for you newcomers, that's all Dick Allgaier had to go on. That's it. And then you'll see him in front of the whiteboard, and he will go to work.
And the other targets that I did, I hadn't gotten any feedback, so I did a couple of other targets, and I'm told, we'll leave those for now and work this. So I didn't know if I'd done a good job on the other targets. I was told was, well, we might get back to that, just leave that. And to me, that either means, oh, man, I blew it, and I've got to get my mind clear and start again. It was all crap. I don't know. It is such a clueless thing when you start working one of these targets. So, okay.
Well, you verified, Dick, on the money, what Jim Morris has spent 52 years researching. That's what I want everyone to understand. This was a spot on, dead on duplication of the work that Jim Morris has put together in over half a century. And Dick Allgaier was able to tune in on that and draw it on the board and describe it as he was doing so. Just astonishing what the human mind is capable of doing. All right, gentlemen, let us step into this. Dick, I'm going to let you take the lead. Describe for our listeners who may not be on the internet or whatever, what it was like, where you were. They put the video in there. If they go to Vimeo tonight, you can get it and watch. So let's take it from the top.
Okay, so I was working this series of targets. I turned a couple of the target works in, which means I had uploaded some video to a place where a repository. I wasn't told anything. I was told do another target. So I start working this other target in late September. September, the 2-3 months ago.
This is after doing our first program that we did. This is after you did the Dealey Plaza and were unaware of it in the beginning, correct?
No.
Okay, this is subsequent to that, and no feedback. How frustrating.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So this one turned out to be, the cue for this was, the viewer will remote view the highest level organizational and planning meeting that orchestrated the assassination of John F. Kennedy. So I, as a remote viewing tasker, Courtney and I have really interesting and conversations about this kind of thing, and I think that's not the best cue. The viewer will remote view the highest level organizational and planning meeting, because who's to say what constitutes a meeting? Who's to say what constitutes the highest level? Like, it could have been a meeting on the 12th floor, but there might have been a more important meeting in the basement, and that would be a lower level. Mm-hmm. What is important is the tasker's intent. It's the tasker's intent. So what the intent of the tasker was, who planned the assassination? That's what they were looking for. That's what we were looking for. And we were thinking, if it was a conspiracy, there was a meeting. I wasn't thinking this, but I wasn't in on this. But that's what the tasker would be looking at. Mm-hmm. Now, from a really low-level analysis standpoint, if the official story is true, if this was a lone nut, if Lee Harvey Oswald planned and executed this by himself with no conspiracy, then what the remote viewers should have viewed would have been a single male maybe reading a newspaper to find the motorcade route, or a guy all alone getting a rifle and some bullets ready for something. You understand what I'm saying? If the highest level planning was just Oswald, I would have only gotten one person in a successful remote viewing.
Todd. Thank you.
Dad Smith would have gotten only one person in a successful remote viewing. Both of us had multiple people in a high-level meeting. So just on that level, I think we proved something. Whether or not who we drew is who it looks like or whatever. What would you say to that, Jim, just on the most basic gestaltic level?
Well, you're absolutely true. And let me point out here that Dick and Daz, that's two separate remote viewings. And I know of two more. Mel Riley took a look at it. Joe McMonagle took a look at the assassination. All four of these separate remote viewings done by separate viewers at separate times and places all say that there was a conspiracy, there are multiple shooters, and there's, you know, et cetera, et cetera. To me, that goes far beyond some kind of mistake or coincidence.
Oh, no question, zero. Let me ask a question, Dick. When you're viewing, to try to give the viewers who look at the video an idea, in your mind, do you come up with, let's call it a snapshot, bang, and then you pick your way through it? Or is it a remote viewing of the past in motion, and you're covering
it's
a period
motion.
Of hours?
It's in motion, but it's short, blurry clips. This time it wasn't that blurry. I had a few moments where I was really on, and that doesn't happen all the time. In this one, the first thing I saw on this target was a man walking down the street in a city with mid-sized buildings, and I was from overhead view. I saw him like I was up three or four stories. I saw him walking, and he walked under like an overhang, an awning, and then he walked out behind that, and then he walked down the street.
Were there other people on the streets?
Yeah.
You were focused. That man caught your attention. Yeah, your attention was drawn to him. Okay.
So then I reset. I looked again, and I was at ground level, and he was walking by. And then I was doing a meditative thing. I said, well, that seems to be important. And I did a breathing exercise and a thing where I bring my body to a stop and the target forms up. And this guy walked right by me and looked right by me, looked right at me. And that's
Whoa. This is fascinating. Now, you said two things. You said you reset, got down to ground level. Was that a conscious decision on your part? I'm going to go down to ground level?
Not exactly. It was more like, oh, I saw this guy, and then I was aware of being back in my room. And this was preliminary work on paper that I was doing before the whiteboard,
okay,
before the dry erase board, right?
So here you are. You're opening the opening scene in Dick Allgaier's movie, busy street, people walking on the sidewalks, except one man seems to be important, and you follow that instinct. This is time travel, Dick.
Well, hey, Dick.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Do you know why I think it is that you were able to get such clear vision on these on this particular one? Let me tell you this.
Why?
Because every time I got the closest to people who were actually directly involved in the assassination, and I'm talking about Lee Oswald's mother, Marguerite, when I was around his wife, Marina, when I was around John de Morinchil, and the de Morinchils were George's wife, and they were the last close friends to Oswald, some of the FBI people, some of the Dallas officials. There was a, and Jeff will tell you, I'm not the most sensitive guy in the whole world, but I could detect a tremendous energy involved in this whole thing. I mean, it was just palpable, and I think that's because of the seriousness of it and because of so many people that were involved.
Oh,
and it
yeah.
It just creates this intense energy field, if you want to call it that.
Understood.
And that's why I think that you were immediately drawn to that and immediately perceived that fairly clearly.
That's fascinating.
I agree with that. I've had experience with that type of thing. If there is a target that's that important that so many people have looked at and are interested in, it's easier to get there. Also, I know other remote viewers have looked at this. They've already made a pathway to that. They've walked down that road before, so I followed them. So I see this guy, and I'm drawing him and I'm probing to get information about him. And what I got was that he was, and he looked right at me the second time I saw him. And I went, oh, and that's,
question, please. When he looked right at you, did he look in your direction? Did he look through you? Or do you feel he made eye contact with you on some level of consciousness?
I don't know. For me, it was as real as if you're on a street and a guy walks by you and he just glances. You know, it wasn't like I had a mind probe with this guy or I was, you know, it was just a...
You think it was coincidental?
Like somebody on the street.
Just a coincidence. A coincidence that he happened to look your way.
Yeah, well,
maybe not.
More like I looked into his face.
I would suggest this may not have been a coincidence, that he may have sensed you back then. Folks, remember, this is truly time travel, what we're talking about here.
Yeah. So I started trying to figure out what the deal was with him, and I sensed that he was going somewhere. He didn't know where he was going, but he just needed to be on the move, kind of like he was agitated. Like if you're walking to go pick up your dry cleaning, you're going to the dry cleaning store. If you're walking to work, you're walking to work. I felt like he was walking to not be where he had been, and he wanted to get somewhere where he didn't know. He was like confused. He was like, he needed to see someone. you know, you, when you probe this, it's like, what's this guy's wants, needs, and desires? What's he's about? And what I got was that he needs to go talk with someone. Someone's got to verify him. He's got to have a meeting, and he's trying to get to a meeting. So,
but you didn't know what the meeting was. At this point in time, you had no idea this was related to the JFK thing.
No, I had no idea if I was even on target. Like, it might have just been, the target might have been something going on in the building, and I saw this guy walk by and followed him. That
got it.
Well, Dick, so, describe the attributes that you saw for this fellow, and then I'll tell you exactly what you were looking at.
He had, like, a shirt on, like a normal casual dress shirt. He had brown hair. He was in his 30s. No tattoos, no scars. Clear eyes, clean shaven. He had a strong jaw, but a small chin, which struck me as like, his chin seems small, but his jaw seems strong. 30s, clean cut. Needed to go somewhere. Needed to meet with someone. I later decided that I felt that he was a spy. The word spion came to me, which I later learned was Russian for spy.
Huh.
And I felt that he had a passport that didn't have his real name on it, and it was a green passport, not a blue. Our passports are blue now. This one seemed green. I think that's what passports used to be. And it had perforated numbers on it. It was this guy's picture, but not his name. I felt he had something in his pocket that was something to do with a meeting, like a phone number or an address or a name or something that was going to help him go to this meeting, and he wanted to go to this meeting.
Now, you're working on paper and pencil at this point, right, still?
Well, some of it is paper and pencil, and then when I go on camera and start drawing it in a larger format, I use some of that, but then more is coming to me. When I get drawing it and I get doing it, then it starts snowballing, and then I'm generating new stuff while I'm there.
Wow.
So I continued the session. And you get this stuff, you look, you see it, and then you got to draw it. And in the act of drawing it, you're back at your desk, or you're back on camera. You're back where you are in your room. And so you've got to go back down in and look again. And next time, I was in a totally different place. I was in nighttime, a misty, foggy night.
Hey, can I stop you right there, Dick, because you're moving on to the car now, which was a whole different
We
view,
want to
right?
focus on that man.
Yeah, let me tell you about this man.
Okay.
First off, I want you to tell me one thing. What kind of work did he do?
Stock boy. I thought that he was a spy for naval intelligence, real smart, real capable.
Yep.
He was given an assignment, and it seemed to be in the U.S., and he didn't understand his assignment. His assignment was something menial, like, hey, move these boxes. And he didn't like that. And he was, like, pissed off because he was highly trained and was given some stupid job that he didn't understand. And, like, why the hell am I like a stock boy?
What am I doing here?
That was...
All right, now...
Let me tell you who I think you were looking at and what was happening.
Yeah?
You were looking at Lee Harvey Oswald. And, in fact, on your drawings, when you've got human number one, it even looks like him. And you're right. Everything's correct except the age. He was not 30. He was 24. But he was a fully grown man and had been to Russia and probably had the appearance of someone a little bit older. I notice on your drawing, too, you've got his shirt, colored shirt, kind of open with a circular line under his chin. as if he's wearing maybe a T-shirt under his shirt, which is exactly what Oswald was wearing the day of the assassination.
Unreal.
Now, you say he was a stock boy and he moved boxes. That was his job at the Texas School Book Depository. Was an order filler. They would get in orders for school textbooks, and he and these other workers would go up and drag down the boxes of school books, move those boxes, and then take them down for shipment to the various schools. It was a very low-level, lowly job, and I'm sure he didn't like it because he was actually, for who he was, he was a pretty intellectual fellow.
I
mean,
wow.
He even had books of Russian literature, Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and those people, you know. And you're not just some street person that reads that stuff.
No, stock
also,
boys don't read that.
He was a spy.
Amazing.
He was a spy.
When
he
came
Russia
back
on a Office of Naval Intelligence operation that as soon as, right before the assassination, when they began to investigate and to look into the fact that some of these, the ONI was sending these American ex-servicemen to Russia to try to see if they could infiltrate them as spies, they got to Lee Harvey Oswald's name, and they shut down that whole office, which shows that there were people high in the government before the assassination who realized they could not have Oswald connected to the government. And yet his mother always told me, my son works for the United States government. So, yes, indeed, he was a spy. In fact, we can go into this a little later, but this is where it ties in to another one of your figures. I'm looking at here an FBI document stated June the 3rd, 1960. This is 3 years before the assassination. And it's to the Office of Security, Department of State, with a copy to the Director of Naval Intelligence. And the subject is Lee Harvey Oswald, and it's from John Edgar Hoover, Director of the FBI. 3 years before the assassination, J. Edgar Hoover sends this memo to the State Department, and the last paragraph says, since there is a possibility that an imposter is using Oswald's birth certificate, any current information the Department of State may have on this subject will be appreciated. So J. Edgar Hoover was personally aware of Lee Harvey Oswald 3 years before the assassination, and in the context of doing intelligence work and someone impersonating him. Is that incredible or what?
That's amazing.
I didn't know that. Is that in your book?
I believe it. I'm pretty sure it's in the revised edition.
The new one, okay.
Yeah, but chances are most people do not know this. It's never been made public in a really meaningful way.
The man who knew too much,
so
Jim Morris.
Number one is Lee Harvey Oswald. He was a spy. He was operating in the United States. He probably was mixed up in several plots. It may have included plotting against the President of the United States. He told his girlfriend, Judith Baker, two nights before the assassination that he was afraid they may be setting him up to be the patsy, and he was almost crying, and she said, well, why don't you get out? And he said, well, I can't. He said, if I try to get out, they'll just kill me. And said, if I stay in, that's one less gun firing at the president. So I think he was trying to alert people above him in the FBI, in the CIA, of what was about to happen, never realizing that these were the very people that were plotting it and setting him up to be the fall guy. Now, to what you were watching, I think you were seeing Oswald as he left the school book depository and walked several blocks. The book depository building is red brick. He passed the Daltex building, which is red brick. I think it had an overhang at that time. And he was confused. He thought that he had warned the FBI. He thought he had warned higher authorities and that they would have stopped the assassination. But then I'm sure by then he had heard everybody screaming and hollering, saying the president's been shot. So now he's really confused. You know, why didn't they stop it? He didn't realize what was happening to him. Now he's really concerned because he's probably beginning to realize that he's being set up to take the blame. And he's heading off, trying to get somewhere, probably the Texas Theater. theater. He wasn't sure of the location, but he had to go somewhere to make an intelligence contact. And we know, I'm pretty certain in my own mind, this is exactly what was happening. Because he went to his rooming house, went in, got a jacket, apparently got this pistol they found on him because he knew his life was in danger now. He goes out and in some mysterious way, which we don't have time to get into, he did not walk or run, but he got, somebody took him to the Texas Theater. And he got in the theater shortly after one. And he went one of the witnesses that I talked to was an 18-year-old kid in there named Davis, John Davis, I think it is. And he was just by himself in this 900-seat theater with only about 20 people scattered through it. And he said this guy came in, he was in the right section up in the middle, and the guy came in and squeezed past him and sat in the seat next to him. And like, what? And that made him a little bit nervous, like, what's that about? But the guy didn't say anything to him. And a few minutes later, he didn't say anything. A few minutes later, the guy gets up, moves over to the center section, sits in the third row, second seat. Uh-huh. And then pretty soon, several minutes later, the lights come on, the police come in, and they arrest this guy. It was Lee Harvey Oswald. And I think that he was trying to make an intelligence contact. And there's further proof of that. When he was arrested, he had a few little odds and ends on him that didn't seem to make any sense. Mm-hmm. For example, he had a piece of paper with his former addresses and his former military stations listed. You know, wait a minute. I was in the Army, and yeah. I went to several schools, and I moved around. I didn't have to make a list of where I'd been.
You can definitely leave home without that.
I knew where I'd been.
Yeah.
And he also had a box top from a Cox's department store box, but not the box, not anything else. And if you know anything about spycraft, you'll know that spies carried these odd little bits of things like
they're identifiers.
They're called bona fides or bona fides, however you want to pronounce it.
Yeah.
And what you do is when you meet somebody you think might be your intelligence contact, like when he sat next to Davis, I think he was waiting for Davis to say, you know, well, it's cool for this time of the year. And he says, yes, but the ducks fly south in the winter. Or, you know, you give some kind of thing to guarantee who you are, and then you show them these little bona fides to show that you are actually, it's spycraft is what it is. And so there you go. And I think that explains so much of what you were saying. And when you heard spion, spion's Russian for spy. By the way, it's the same thing in German. Spion is German for spy. He was a spy. He was a low-level
What amazes me, Jim, is what you said about him talking to his girlfriend 2 days before and crying.
Right.
He knew.
He knew what was coming up.
He knew. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's confused. Are they really doing this to me? And he's trying to make intelligence contact. One further thing, and this is a whole thing that nobody knows about much. When he was in jail, he tried to make a call to a guy named John Hurt in Raleigh, South Carolina. And there were two suits, feds probably, who came in the telephone operator's room there and got the main telephone operator and said, you're expecting a call, don't put it through. So Oswald, he gets his phone call while he's in jail, and he tries to call this John Hurt in South Carolina, and the operator says, I'm unable to connect that call. And yet her friend who's sitting there next to her is aghast because she said she didn't even try to connect the call. Okay, and then these two guys thanked her and left, and she tore up the little slip of the call thing, but her friend filled out the call slip with the name Hurt, with the telephone number, the date, and the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald tried to call this guy. And who was John Hurt? He was a former military intelligence officer who had worked in training at Nag's Head, South Carolina, where Oswald did his intelligence training. And I know this because while he was there, he met my friend Tosh Plumlee, who was also undergoing intelligence training there, along with some of the anti-Castro Cubans. And so here, Oswald tried in vain to place a call to an intelligence contact who he had hoped, I'm sure, would put him in touch with his handler, his intelligence handler, who would hopefully get him out of this
mess.
Get
him out of there. Yeah. Trying to save his life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
wow.
But he didn't realize that they weren't even going to let him make his phone call.
I have a stupid question.
No such thing.
You said that he told his girlfriend. Wasn't Oswald married to Marina?
Yes, he was. Yes, he was. But there was a rocky marriage.
I never heard he had a girlfriend.
And when he was in New Orleans over the summer of 63, there's a whole long story there. You'd need to read her account. This is Judith Very Baker, who actually, and both of them said, he never got the chance to say this, but Judith Very Baker, who is still alive, says that both she and Oswald were working on behalf of the CIA, or at least the federal government. And they were both connected to David Ferry, Guy Bannister and these people in New Orleans that were mixed up in the Jim Garrison investigation and the plot to kill Kennedy there. But she said that, I have seen her work receipts, her pay receipts from Riley Coffee Company, and she was there at the exact same time as Oswald. And in fact, it was her job to cover for him because his job at Riley was simply a front, and he was actually leaving to go and work at David Ferry's cancer lab.
Jim, how did you find out about Judith Very Baker?
Well, that's a good question. I guess I heard about her somehow, and then
her up in the phone book.
Well, she was over in Dallas.
Yeah, but
so
somebody mentioned her.
And also met with her sister and some of her other relatives.
Yeah, but in the very beginning, how did you come on to her?
That's a good question.
Well, there is hypnotic regression. We can take you back.
I can't remember. Can't remember everything.
That's very interesting to me, how you would find that out. Just absolutely fascinating. And you see, folks, 52 years Jim's been after this. He's talked to them all. He's a national treasure when it comes to this. And now here comes Dick Allgaier, Daz Smith, Joe McMonagle. Who was the other? Lynn?
Oh, Mel Riley.
Mel Riley. And all four of them hit the basic same target in a very similar fashion. But Dick and Daz have done it most recently and most vividly. And you can see this on video, and I would urge you to go to the Farsight Institute. It's farsight.org. And isn't that it, Dick?
Yeah, farsight.org.
All right. And
there's
you can
a link
get
that will take you to Vimeo.
You go get it tonight. This is just history. I'm going to repeat it one more time. As mind-blowing as it may seem to be, as impossible as it may seem for many of you, Dick Allgaier and Daz Smith and the other good viewers are capable of time travel both forward and backwards, okay? That's the amazing part about the human mind and what Dick has taught himself over so many years. It's like a tremendous athletic talent. A lot of discipline, and we have much to be grateful for. Okay, Dick, go ahead.
Jim, what was the deal with the pistol? Did Oswald have a pistol on him when he was arrested? They said he murdered a cop, Tippett, right?
Right.
When did he
Tippett.
Get that?
Well, number one, he could not have murdered Tippett because, according to three witnesses, including the assistant manager of the Texas Theater, he was already in the theater at the time the cop was shot several blocks away. So he did not shoot Tippett. Furthermore, that .38 pistol he had, when Officer McDonald, who I don't think was in on the whole thing, he just happened to be near the theater. He goes in there, and while the other cops were up on the stage turning on the house lights and getting witnesses to try to point to who was near in there, and they started working their way back row by row, you know, excuse me, sir, show some ID. And they gave Oswald every opportunity to make a run for it. And I think the plan probably was to kill him and resisting arrest
dead
or trying
man,
to flee
tell
the
no
cop.
Tales, kill
but
him.
He didn't do it, okay? And he did have this .38 pistol on him. I think he probably picked it up, and I think he got it at his rooming house before he arrived at the theater, because now he knew his life was in danger. Okay?
He didn't want to die.
He didn't want to die. And so McDonald comes up to him, and according to McDonald, the very next day, he said that Oswald pulled his pistol and said, well, it's all over now, or something like that, and that he heard the gun snap. And believe me, if somebody's pointing a .38 in your stomach and you hear it go snap, you're going to really remember that. And because McDonald, as he said in his report to the AP the next day, he said, well, I was just so thankful that it didn't go off, you know, and shoot me. And so later, the Warren Commission trying to explain this because, you know, hey, if his gun didn't work then, how could it have worked, you know, killing the policeman? So, in fact, the FBI later buried in all the mass of the Warren Commission, they said they had to repair the firing pin on this .38 because it was bent and it wouldn't fire.
Wow.
Is that amazing? Nobody has told these things.
That's truly amazing.
So Oswald's pistol couldn't fire. And so I'm sure the Warren Commission, these sharp lawyers covering for the government, it's like, wait a minute, how are we going to explain that his gun didn't work? And then we try to say this is what he used to kill the policeman. So they came up with this cockamamie story that McDonald was trained as a policeman to jam his flesh between the thumb and forefinger down with the hammer, between the hammer and the gun, so that when he pulled the trigger, it would hit his hand instead of the gun, and that's why the gun didn't go off. But this is ridiculous, because if a hammer on a revolver snaps on your hand, believe me, you're going to know it. It's going to hurt like holy hell. And McDonald would have certainly mentioned that, but he didn't. He said he heard it go click and it didn't fire.
He heard it go click, kind of like this.
Yep.
And he wouldn't have fired no matter how many times he pulled the trigger.
That's right.
I was just imitating
to show you that the game was already fixed, the reason they arrested Oswald in the theater is because the ticket seller had called the Dallas police and said, hey, a guy sneaked in the theater and didn't pay for his ticket. And somebody did, by the way. This isn't a whole other thing. Somebody did enter the theater.
But it wasn't him.
And didn't pay. But it wasn't him. He was already in the theater. So
they led them to
the theater because he sneaked in about 1:30. The ticket seller called the police, said a man just slipped in the theater. Well, based on that, you know, they rushed 15 squad cars, FBI, district attorneys, even men who said they were with the CIA, which nobody much had heard of in that day. All right. And there they all are. And they run in, they hustle out with Oswald. And instead of saying, well, that'll teach you to sneak in without buying a ticket, they're shouting, kill the president, will you? So they already had him nailed. They already knew who they were after, and they already, the whole game was afoot.
Wow. Stand by. We have to take a break here, Dick. Hold on. I'm sorry.
Okay.
We've got to pause
right
at the top for 4 minutes or so, and we'll come right back. Hour number two in our historic program with Dick Allgaier, remote viewer, and the world's greatest foremost researcher, Jim Morris, on the JFK assassination. Be right back.